Right. Good morning, everybody. I'm very happy to have another chance to give you some more details about Elastic CNG, what we can learn from them. And just one second. And today I will mostly focus on the stellar content of galaxies as this random selection of stellar stamps from illustrious objects is meant to evoke. I have quite a plan for the next 20 minutes. I will first give you some quantity details about my personal declination of the galaxy-halo connection, where you substitute galaxy with stellar halos. Following up on Mark Fokusberger and Yop Shire's talks, I will give you some further details on how baryonic physics can alter dark matter knowledge. And I will show a preliminary plot, some preliminary notes about the scatter in the stellar to halo mass relation in our simulations. Our simulations are, not surprisingly, illustrious TNG, but I also will show something about Eris as my personal acknowledgement to my previous collaborators here in sunny California. But since I've actually worked mostly on TNG in the last 2 years, I want to give you my personal introduction to the simulations. And by the end of the week, you will be fed up completely hearing us talking about TNG. But actually, what I think is really interesting is that now with both Elastis and Elastis TNG, we can really go after some model-independent statements about galaxies. So the Elastis TNG project could not exist without the contribution of many people. You have seen these faces, a bunch of people between southern Germany and the East Coast, all captained by Volker Springer and Lars Enquist. And as Dylan and Mark have already shown you, we wanted with the TNG, we wanted to try to solve the issues identified in the illustrious galaxies and halos. And to do that, we needed to modify the underlying physical assumption, or say, physical mechanisms we want to include. And we have done that by changing the model. We have changed aspect of the black hole feedback and aspect of the galactic winds. The results are shown in these plots, which I've also seen before. It's just a random, it's very important. So it's a series of stellar quantity of the galaxy populations. And in red are the implementation, the results from the fiducial illustrious model. In black, the results from the fiducial TNG model, all on the same exact galaxy population, the same box cosmology. As you can see here, changes to the galactic winds have allowed us to, for example, suppress more efficiently star formation at the low mass end. Changes in the AGM feedback has allowed, for example, to avoid vacating the group and cluster scale of the gas, as you can see here, for example, in the gas fraction versus halo mass relation. So equipped with these models, we have now been running a series of simulations. You have seen our family picture of the TNG suite. These are three boxes, TNG 100, 300, and 50. The name is meant to tell you approximately the size in megaparsec of our periodic boxes. And TNG 100 and TNG 300 are completed. This one is ongoing. And we have applied the same exact model across these boxes, which actually go across resolution, improving from the big box to the smaller one. We have updated the cosmology. They all include MHD. And what you can, for example, notice is that we now, with the big 300 megaparsec box, we have really incredible statistics also at the high mass end. TNG 100 is the exact replica of Elastris, but for the change in the model, with the same initial conditions modulo the change in the cosmology. But I think the best way to actually describe you this simulation actually show you what is in there. So this is the picture, these are images of TNG 100. This is essentially 100 megaparsec. This is a whole volume projection. And you can see, for example, the dark matter density, the gas density, the velocity field of the dark matter, the temperature of the gas on small and large scales. This is, for example, if you were looking with an X-ray observatory, this box. This is the metallicity of the gas, just to tell you that we enrich, of course, the surrounding regions around galaxies, but it can also pollute the IGM. And this is something new, for example. This is the ratio of the metallicity in the gas due to supernova type 1A over the metallicity due to AGB stars. We told you we can now track individually the contribution from the different sites, and we can now study whatever we want, which we don't know exactly what, but we'll see. Another new aspect of it, this is the strength of the magnetic fields, where you can see that the magnetic fields get amplified more there where there is more gas, more dense gas. And finally, we told you in the past that we now have a shock finder. So if you plot the distribution of the Mach numbers, you can see something like this, the accretion shocks pictured in these images. And if you actually plot the energy dissipated through this shock, you can actually start to see features not only of the gravitational collapse, but also of the feedback, to be honest, if I was to zoom in. But I promised I will be talking about stars. However, I was indulging in these gas properties just to keep in mind that the galaxy-halo connection is mediated by gas, and this cannot ever be forgotten. All right, I'm going to talk about stellar halos and how they can trace the assembly and dark matter halos. The bottom line is, if you can measure the slope of stellar halos, you know the concentration of the dark matter. Well, actually, it's not really true. I wish it was true. I started this project hoping for that, but it's not the case, at least not according to Illustrious. However, the stellar halos encode a plethora of information about the total halo mass of their host and the fixed halo mass of the formation time and the type of galaxies at their centers, and I'm going to quantify and demonstrate this in the next slides. In fact, we know now, we know now from simulation, okay, there should have been a movie, she's not going. All right, we now know from hydrodynamical simulations that the hierarchical growth structure implies two channels to build up the stellar mass content of galaxies. Of course, we have the C2 star formation and the X-C2. X-C2 stars are brought in by satellite galaxies that then get stripped and leave their material in the outskirts of galaxies. And so anytime we think about the galaxy, we know more or less that, yes, the central regions are mostly dominated by in-situ, the outer regions are mostly dominated by X-C2 stars. But the vice versa is not true. And now we can, for example, with simulation like Illustrious, to go even farther beyond Milky Way-only galaxies, and plot, for example, the C2 stellar mass fraction as a function of stellar mass. This is something we were commenting the other day. The fraction of X-C2 stars in galaxies spikes up as you go to the high mass end. And there is quite some halo-to-halo variation here, a large scatter that we can now quantify. Again, these scatters are not random. They're just depicting, they're just showing us some underlying physical processes. In this paper from a student of Harvard, we could actually quantify that the fixed stellar mass, for example, elliptical galaxies, and those formed at the center of younger halos have larger X-C2fractions, for example. This trend is rather robust across models. Illustrious, in this case, was given sort of an average across the models until now. Illustrious TNG is still producing a similar trend, perhaps slightly different. In this plot, for example, however, I'm showing you the X-C2 stellar mass fraction across the whole galaxies plus halo. If you go to the middle of the galaxies, as I'm showing you here, you still see similar trends. However, as you go from the inner regions of galaxies to outer regions of galaxies, the X-C2 goes down. However, you can still find a lot of X-C2 stars in the middle of your massive galaxies. You can also study how the galaxies assemble as a function of time in different mass bins. This is also something we have been done in Illustrious. And you can see that the two-phase model, the one which says that galaxies are building their material by in-situ up to a given redshift and then they just accrete material, this two-phase model applies only to the most massive galaxies, at least according to Illustrious. Perhaps in Illustrious TNG, this boundary will go slightly down. But for all other galaxies, it's true. In-situ star formation dominates at all times. So having said that, we can now I can now show you that simulations like Illustrious, Illustrious TNG, they naturally reproduce thousands of galaxies, and each of them is surrounded by stellar halos. So stellar halos, for me, are the vague name of low surface brightness regions of galaxies, so where you have diffuse light. And you can have many morphologies. You can have elongated stellar halos, spherical ones, very homogeneous. You can have shells, streams, umbrella, whatever you like. And we can now study those in details. And in the remaining of my talk, by stellar halo, I mean whatever stars are beyond a given boundary in a fixed aperture, as opposed to the galaxies, which is whatever star is inside this boundary. And again, I also would say that the intracluster light, for me, is simply the stellar halo of massive objects, just to set up the nomenclature. So regardless of the inhomogeneities and in lumpiness in the low surface brightness region, you can always do two things with stellar halo: measuring their mass and measuring their profiles. And I will focus mostly on the profiles. So if you plot the stellar density 3D spherically average profiles of stellar halos around disk galaxies or elliptical galaxies, you obtain something like this. This is the analog, the corresponding dark matter profile. To be honest, you can always fit a power law to whatever you want as long as you constrain yourself to a given radial beam. And if you go beyond a given outer aperture, this is what we have done. We have measured the alpha slopes of the stellar profiles in the outskirts of galaxies, actually beyond the hard half radius, the stellar half mass radius. It turns out that the stellar halo slope profile correlates quite nicely with the halo mass. Larger halos have shallower stellar halos. In any case, the slopes of the stellar halos are always steeper than the dark matter profiles. And what you can see, for example, we can have a prediction for the slopes of Milky Way-like galaxies. But what is really relevant is that, again, we can quantify the scatter at fixed halo mass, which is not stochastic. In fact, it turns out that if we, for example, if we plot a disk, beautiful disk or beautiful elliptical galaxies, they already disentangle here in this plot. Stellar halos turn out they know about the galaxies at their centers. To be honest, I should say vice versa, but we'll see that. So here I show the usual plot, alpha of the stellar halo as a function of halo mass. And I split in fixed halo mass beams, I split based on the mass of the galaxies at their center, the morphology, the color, the stellar ages. And what you can see is that at fixed halo mass, more massive disk-like blue and young galaxies are surrounded by tendentially steeper stellar halos than the analog elliptical red old counterparts. This is all related, to be honest, to how these galaxies assemble. In fact, if I go farther and I plot actually in beams of halo mass, the slope of the stellar halo is a function of something related to the assembly, which is halo formation time, the total halo formation time, we see a trend. So the dark matter halos which form more recently exhibit shallower stellar halos. And this is quite okay, it happens in beams up to a certain mass. Similarly, I can formulate this based on the mass, accreted stellar mass, the C2 stellar fraction, and this again, dark matter halo which accreted more stars exhibit shallower stellar halos at fixed halo mass. I'm not saying anything that these two are correlated. However, the idea is that yes, more massive halos accrete more satellites, and these are more luminous than the ones that fall into smaller halos, but what it really matters is how this material gets distributed. And if you are a dark matter halo that form more recently, the apocenters of your satellites and and where you strip your stars are actually at larger distances than older halos. And this is the same as it happens in dark matter. I skip this. And so this is why we were looking for a connection between the dark matter stellar halo properties and the dark matter halo properties. Here I show alpha stars between, say, the nastroscale radius and the half of the Biela radius, and in the same radius, the profile, the same exact average profile slope of the dark matter. And as you can see again in beams, they are correlated. That you find steeper slopes, steeper stellar halos there where the dark matter is also steeper. So then we went further and we asked, okay, can we actually see a connection between the slope of the stellar halo and the concentration? It turns out not to be there. So at fixed dark matter halo mass, there's no clear connection between the alpha stars and the concentration. However, this holds. The steeper stellar halos live in steeper dark matter halos. And the reason for which this gets messed up is because of baryonic effects. And I'll come to that in a minute. But before going to that, I actually would like to tell you why I'm so focused on slopes and not masses. Well, if you guys have a chance to quote both stellar masses or whatever you have, or profiles, please do both. But profiles are really interesting, and here I mean the slope, say, of a power load, not the normalization. The normalization is essentially telling you the mass. And why is that? Well, we know. We have talked about it all week. The choice of the boundary between the galaxy star halo is completely arbitrary. And in a sense, this is true also for where we define our own galaxies. This is a stellar to halo mass relation as a function of M halo in our new TNG 100 simulation. And just to tell you that where I actually count the mass of a galaxy change of course as a function of aperture. Everything else is fixed. IMF, mass to light ratios, you know, these kind of things. And what I want to point out is that the definitions matters not just at the high mass end, but even at the peak. So for stellar halos, it's similar, of course. But what I would argue is that the characterization of profiles are more robust, the characterization of the mass in the stellar halo. Here's, for example, the slope of the stellar halo as a function of halo mass in various apertures in the outskirts. And as you can see, the median trends are always the same. If I did something similar with the masses, the fraction of mass in the outskirts over the mass in the galaxy, I can get any results according to where I put my boundary. In fact, the profiles are quite robust, also kind of against models. And here I show you, for example, how our alpha stars versus M halo relation of Illustris, which is the red, gets modified in Illustris TNG. All right. But I promise I wanted to give you some more quantitative details about the convolution of galaxies in dark matter. The bottom line is, yes, that we know since a while presence of baryons may affect the phase-space properties of the underlying dark matter. And, well, this complicates, at the very least, whatever we can say about cosmology when we use galaxies. And this is why I voted in one direction, not the other, despite my past in cosmology. I just think that actually we now need to improve our understanding of how we do galaxies to then go back to derive cosmological constraints using galaxies or galaxy clusters. And we can talk about marginalization, but I'll show you the problems. So, for example, here is just a simplification of how baryons can modify everything about a Milky Way-like galaxy. This is Eris. The dark matter profiles are changed. The shapes are changed. The Sabella abundances are changed. They are going down, as in Latte. The distribution of the velocity in the vicinity of the Sun also get modified. So this also will impact what we can say about the nature of dark matter in the dark matter searches. But now I go beyond and I show what we get in Illustris. We have already mentioned, for example, that the same definition of M200 changes when you put baryonic physics. And this is, for example, the distance between the mass in hydro and mass in dark matter as a function of halo mass in Illustris and TNG 100. So this has important implications because indeed it changes the fitting formula, say, for dark matter halo mass function, which are used in cosmology. This is from Bouquet et al., and this is how the hydro fitting functions are coming from the magneticum. And this is, for example, the constraints on sigma 8 omega m if you do an E-Rosita experiment in X-ray, and how you can actually go away from the ellipses. You have a huge systematic bias here. The challenge now is, of course, to identify the trends which are consistent across models, because, for example, if I plot Eagle on top of it, we can see that it's, again, completely different at certain mass ranges, but we can find some overlapping regions of consistency. All right, and this is another way to see this. These are the circular velocity curve of dark matter as a function of radius. This is from a postdoc working with me, Mark Lovell. You can see the dark matter analog profiles, the Illustris full physics, and the Illustris TNG full physics. They are getting more contracted, say, in the new model compared to the old one. And this is all because, to be honest, we are changing how the baryons are also distributed behind. This is indeed the circular velocity of the total dark matter plus baryons. And you can see we are changing quite a bit how we are cooking up our galaxies with their stars and their gas. As a corollary, I just want to also put a cautionary note that the meaning of Vmax changes dramatically from dark matter only to full physics simulations, because in full physics simulation, your Vmax may be completely dominated by the stars. And so then we also have to keep this in mind. I told you that the dark matter halo seems to be more contracted in TNG and in Illustris compared to the dark matter only. Here is another way of seeing it. This is the dark matter halo concentration as a function of halo mass. To be honest, we are screwing up the concentration mass relation. Whether this is right or not, we don't know yet. But indeed, we have a boost of concentrations at 10 to the 12 solar masses. We are doing it quite differently now in TNG corresponding to 100 and to Elastris. And in Eagle, for example, the concentration mass relation is not changed too much. If you imagine, if you throw subhalos in halos that are more contracted, you may destroy them more. And this is also our take on the abundance of subhalos when you put physics. This is just from Elastris and not TNG. We do see that the subhalo mass functions get tilted, that overall we find that, generally speaking, we suppress the total community abundance of small subhalos, both luminous and dark, we didn't check. But this is happening also already at INFO, and this is mostly due to the fact that we changed the mass. In fact, if we can go further, given that we have so many objects, we can actually quantify the scatter, but I think, and we know that, so that the halo to halo variation is large. It grows from INFO to the current time. But what is really remarkable, I think, is that the baryonic physics do not enhance the scatter. And indeed, this is one of these qualitative statements that I think is pretty interesting and worthwhile to check. All right, I have my last slide, and I promise I'll be fast. But I couldn't avoid to show you what we get in terms of the scatter in the galaxy's stellar mass at fixed halo mass. And the take-home message is we do consistently get a rather small scatter at the high mass end. So this is sigma in log 10 of stellar mass as a function of halo mass. Some constraints we have been talking about these days. And this is the scatter in TNG 100. This is Elastris, and this is in the large box. What Eagle gets is in the gray behind here. And I think now, yes, so it's really interesting indeed. At the high mass end, we all tend to converge to rather low levels of scatter, but all hydro simulations, I mean, these three hydro simulations, agree that there is an explosion of the scatter at the low mass end. And actually, also what I would like to point out, and I will close, is that while the stellar masses may be actually resolution dependent, the scatter is not. So TNG 100 and TNG 300 are at different resolution and are on top of each other. Okay, I will take question, and I'll leave a movie just to show some additional effects of different models.
Thank you, Annalisa. We'll do Benedict, and then.
Yeah, very interesting stuff about the stellar halos. I got a bit lost when you showed that, so there is a correlation between the slope of the dark matter halo and the stellar halo, but not with the concentration of the Einasto profile of the dark matter halo.
Yeah.
And so that seems a bit surprising at first, but is it maybe, so the slope and the alpha, the concentration on alpha of the Einasto profile are often very degenerate. So what would happen if you plotted NFW concentration there?
So I skipped this because I didn't have much time, but it's true. If you take an embodied simulation and you plot the slope of the dark matter, say, after Einasto, this has to go after less than minus 2, and say to half of the Vira radius, and you plot it as a function of concentration, every mass bin is on the same track, for example. However, if you go to Elastris with the full physics with baryonic effects, these tracks are messed up. So we are changing, in fact, we are changing the shape. And we are forced, in a sense, what I also saw is that we are forcing to fit our profiles with Einasto. Maybe this is not the best representation, maybe not even our Frank and White in a sense. And actually, we are changing a bit the derivatives, yes, in different points of our profiles. And this actually was a bit of the annoyance for us, because we mess up this. And in the end, we had a beautiful connection between slopes in the same radial bins of stars and their matter, but we lost the general concentration, the description, the concentration is a more general description of the halo, I would say.
I was very interested when you showed a correlation between the outer slope of the dark matter and the outer slope of the stellar profile, namely that when one is steeper, the other seems to be steeper. In studying the dark matter halos, what Christoph Lee has found, something that I didn't mention yesterday in my talk, is that when the halos are in dense regions, up to about 10 to the 12 solar masses, they're frequently tidally stripped. And that corresponds to a steeper outer dark matter profile. It also means that star formation has usually ceased quite early because there's no more infall. And so they also tend to have older stellar populations. So the question is, have you looked in Lustrous to see what the cause of the steeper outer profiles is? And is it perhaps in denser regions, maybe connected with tidal stripping? And if you haven't looked, I suggest that you do.
Mm-hmm. I'll check. I mentioned this connection with the galaxies. And so then, in the end, we are mixing here a bit of possible connection with the, when we stop doing star formation and whether the central galaxy is an elliptical versus the assembly history. It's good to check.
Hi, Annalisa. Nice talk. I have a question on your kind of high mass end. You know, you showed that the centrals have relatively small scatter and stellar mass with respect to halo mass. Have you tried going out and looking at the total stellar content within, say, R500, R200, and then I'm going to follow on to ask about closed-box nature or closed-back whatever you want to say.
Oh, no. Here? See, you're right. So here, for example, I was showing the galaxy mass. So within 2R half, I've done the same scatter going farther out, 100 kiloparsec, 90% of the mass. Well, I don't find a scatter going up. But I do find that if I actually do the scatter of the stellar halo, so I just go from 100 kiloparsec outside, then I do see the scatter going up. Mm-hmm.
I guess I'd be interested to go all the way out to R200 crit, right, and take not just the central, the light associated
with
the central.
This is what I'm saying.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah. Great. So you go as far out as you can. Yeah.
And then if I could follow up, stellar mass fraction as a function of mass, I forget which plot that was, but the canonical plot. You seemed a little high. Are you getting too much ICL, do you think, with right now compared to observations, or is that to be deep?
We actually think that now, since we are getting dwarfs and Milky Ways that are more in agreement, say, with the galaxy star mass function at various redshifts and the stellar halo mass relation, we are thinking now we are populating the intracluster light with the right amount of mass. And so are you thinking about, I don't know, did I show this or did I skip this? Sorry, I forgot. So this was the mass fraction in the outskirts to total, and this is what we get. It's really relevant where people are measuring the intracluster light, starting from which radius outwards.
Hi. Very nice. First, I just want to say I completely agree with you that the profile is really, really important. My question is, I'm very curious about the X2 component in the inner region of the massive galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, if you separate the X2 component, like say in the within RE, are there any difference with the axial component in the outskirt? For example, are they more likely come from major merger or in terms of formation time or the metallicity? Are there any difference with
Yeah, so we have checked this a little bit in a follow-up paper with Ben Cook, a student from Harvard, where we went to elliptical galaxies, just elliptical galaxies from Illustris. And whatever I've been showing you so far is translated here into these surface brightness profiles. And this is a proxy for mass. And we were dividing the galaxies in inner halo, in inner galaxy within RE. Then we went a bit farther out. Okay. And in this paper, our stellar halo is pretty close by. It's between 2 and 4 RE. And what we can see is that if we plot the surface profile of the brightness, or the gradient in metallicity, or the gradient of the ages, within the inner parts of galaxies, we don't see many trends. Now, this is while the trends start to appear when you go out. So this, I think, is the answer to your question. So if you go inside, in your galaxy, even without distinguishing in C2 or X2, we don't see strong trends with mass. And in a plot that I don't have, we don't see strong trends in assembly properties. We need to go outside from the galaxy to see these trends. This is what we find. But please check, because who knows, maybe in other simulations different and observations different.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the same point. I think you expect that the stars that get to the middle should preferentially come from the more massive accretors. So this, I think, was probably related to your question, because this would be reflected in the metallicity distribution.
Yeah.
So can you, I mean, it's easy for you to check whether the ex situ stars near the middle come preferentially from more massive objects than the ex situ stars at large radius.
These absolutely. These we can.
My own question was, as you showed and pointed out in your pictures, you can see very clearly that the large radius, there's an enormous amount of structure in the stellar halos. Mm-hmm. And, so it's not obvious that just spherically averaging and taking a logarithmic profile is the best way to characterize that. Mm-hmm. So have you looked at whether some measure of the structure in the outer halo correlates with the other things you were looking into?
It's the program of my group, so not yet. But yes, we should definitely characterize the lumpiness. One first thing would be indeed to do the excess of material when you subtract an homogeneous 3D spherically averaged profile and see how it correlates, and I think it would correlate really strongly. And although, whatever, this statement will depend on halo mass and redshift. But yes, absolutely.
So it's beautiful seeing these predictions, because earlier this week we saw from Song observations of the outer slopes from Hyper Supreme Cam. I'm wondering, how long will it take to put together just a direct comparison of the slopes predicted and the slopes observed at the same radius? Okay,
yes.
Good.
Hi. I have a question. Quick, a super simple question. I know it wasn't the main subject of your talk, but you put a slide up about cluster cosmology. I just wanted to know if you could comment a little bit on exactly how that calculation was done. And the reason why I'm asking this question, I'm not saying that I'm giving up my arrow. I'm showing which direction my arrow goes to Marla right now. But one of the ways I think about it, and you think you can possibly think about it, I'm not claiming this is certainly the right way, but I wrote a couple of papers with Doug Rudd and Heidi Wu, who's in the audience here. And basically our perspective on this was, it may not actually matter if the mass changes in the hydro simulation, right? You can use the equivalent dark matter-only simulation mass as just a label for the mass-observable
relation. Then you change your mass-observable relation, though.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so the question is how well or how much confidence do you have that you can calibrate that to some... And so the question is... But the reason why I'm asking the question is I don't know exactly how this particular calculation was done, and so that matters, right? You may not actually realize all of this bias. You probably won't realize all of this.
I think what they did here was the dark matter halo mass function. You take the M hydro and you do then you go to X-ray luminosity with M hydro. Mm-hmm. In a sense, we don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, the observable mass relation could be changed.
Right.
However, what I would like, I agree. We can always marginalize over our ignorance on how things are changed by baryonic effects, but also the functional forms of what we marginalize over determine our results,
honest. Of course.
So this is really, and so what I'm working on is like just to give a hint in which direction one should change the functional forms, and then the parameters, you can marginalize them.
Sure, of course. I mean, I'm just saying you probably won't get all of the bias that you get out of such a calculation, right? The harder problem actually is probably the concentrations one. It's actually probably worse for cosmology, but anyway.
So I know there are more questions, but let's take them to break and thank Annalisa again.